Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we've got a crisis right here on our borders, one that evokes all of the irony and history of the holiday we are about to celebrate here in the United States, the 4th of July. People coming from lands where they feel they are persecuted to find freedom in America, but finding something different.
U.S. citizens have to pay taxes, higher taxes, in order to support these people. It's just not fair. We can't take care of our own.
Our homeless veterans, American workers. The suffering American population is going to be negatively impacted by this movement.
A lot of them are criminals.
Our message absolutely is don't send your children unaccompanied on trains or through a bunch of smugglers. We don't even know how many of these kids don't make it and may have been waylaid into sex trafficking or killed because they fell off a train. We have no way of tracking that.
The irony of being drawn to America in this 4th of July season and hearing a message, even from the president there, to stay away from our borders. Some 50,000 Central American children have streamed across the U.S.-Mexico border unaccompanied by parents since October of last year. The children come from fleeing extreme violence and poverty in their home countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. That's a report from the UNHCR found that a full 58% of the children are forcibly displaced from their homeland because they have suffered or face harms that require international protection. We've heard from all sorts of sides of the political spectrum on this in our coverage of this crisis. Now we turn to Norma Torres, who's a state senator representing California's 32nd senatorial district. Norma Torres, welcome to The Takeaway.
Yes. Hello, John. It is very unfortunate what is happening with the 50,000 refugees that are coming into the U.S.
And you would call them refugees. Describe, if you can, the conditions that, as you understand it, they are fleeing in Guatemala.
Absolutely. I had an opportunity to visit Guatemala 3 years ago, invited by the vice president. And I got, you know, the first opportunity to speak to the youth in Guatemala. There is so much violence. People are being murdered every single day in front of their homes in Guatemala.
Can I just to explore a little bit the details of some of that? Now, you've got a situation here, as we understand it, that, you know, parents are coming north to try to get a better life for themselves. They're essentially economic refugees, political refugees, call them what you will, coming to the United States, leaving their children behind. Would you say that that parentless child situation in a place like Guatemala contributes to the instability and the gang activity in Guatemala that then contributes to the instability that we're seeing as these refugees flee northward?
I think that what has happened over the years is in the 80s, we had a lot of immigrants come in, many of them young children. A lot of them were jumped into gangs. We were not prepared for that population. Went after serving their jail sentences, they were deported back, you know, to their homelands. And unfortunately, because the crimes that they committed were here in the U.S. and not in their homeland, they were, you know, set free and allowed to live within these populations that we are now seeing gangs that initiated here in California or here in the U.S. have grown to the extent that they are uncontrollable in these Central American countries. What is happening with these children is either they were abandoned because their parents were murdered at the hands of gang members or drug dealers, or they were abandoned because their parent felt that they needed to seek a better life in the U.S. and send money. And these children were left with an elderly, ailing grandparent, maybe, who just couldn't take care of them.
What is your response to the president's suggestion and really demand that people, that children not try to come forward to be reunited with their parents on their own?
Well, I do support, you know, getting a message to Central America and to these children that the treacherous path for them to get to the U.S. is so dangerous for them. 1,000 miles, they have to go through Mexico, some very, very violent towns in Mexico. A lot of them are being forced into prostitution. A lot of them are being forced into slave-like conditions and having to work in these small towns in Mexico. And unless we have a sure plan that they are going to implement and that we can see that implementation of a security plan that is going to help them control their gang problem and control the drug problem that they have, that in many ways, you know, we have created because of the demand of these hardcore drugs in the U.S.
All right. Well, what do you make of this proposal from U.S. Congressional Representative Candace Miller, who's a Republican from Michigan?
Instead of increasing funding, hundreds of millions of dollars, as the president has called for, I think we need to stop foreign aid to the Centrals immediately. I mean, we would be better off spending this money in the inner cities of America. We can start with Detroit.
Now, you're running for Congress, so you understand that that is a fairly popular sentiment right now across the country.
It is, and it is a political way of, you know, trying to address a growing problem that this, unfortunately, is an election year. What I would say to Congresswoman Miller is that is a short-sighted way of looking at things, is that, you know, it is important to the U.S. economy, and it is important to the U.S. security that we ensure that the Central American countries, you know, are stabilize. That is, for me, a priority.
Is it short-sighted then to have these Nogales, Arizona, you know, detention centers and these short-term kinds of facilities that look like pretty grim cages for kids as the U.S. Homeland Security Department tries to get them reunited with their parents or get them shipped elsewhere in the U.S.?
When I look at these temporary placements where these children are being held, I think that it is a black eye, you know, on our nation. I think that when the world is looking at this these images of children sleeping on the floor, sleeping in warehouses and jail cells, you know, that does not look good on the U.S. I think that we can do better than that. We're not dealing, you know, with a criminal element that is coming here, you know, to pillage our towns. We are dealing with very, very young children that once again, you know, have left their home countries because there is no future for them. They are at risk of being murdered or they are at risk of being jumped into a gang and forced into a crime.
But you've also called them gang members and people who are experienced in violent crime. And I'm just wondering if that makes you sympathetic with some of the protesters who are screaming, these are criminals. We've got to close the borders. We've got to increase security.
I would not call these very young children criminals. I am sympathetic, you know, to the protesters that are seeing, you know, thousands of people coming into you know, our nation here in the U.S. And not understanding how are we going to deal with it. And I think that, you know, that reflects on the inability of Congress, you know, to be able to work together. This is not a partisan issue. This is an issue that I believe the UN ought to be watching and ought to weigh in on what is happening here with these kids.
Well, the UN definitely is watching. Final question, Norma Torres, you are running for Congress, for the U.S. Congress. Right now you represent California's 32nd senatorial district. Do you think your experience, the fact that you are from Guatemala and have direct experience with this issue, helps you or hurts you in your congressional campaign right now? You've won your Democratic primary.
I won my Democratic primary by 67%, you know, which I've been representing this area for quite a long time. My constituents know where I stand on issues. There are no surprises here for them. I came to the U.S. when I was a little girl, too. And while my circumstances might have been a little bit different than those children, I still was forced, you know, out of my home in Guatemala because my mother was very ill, and my father felt that I would be better off, you know, with his brother living here in the U.S. His older brother was already living here, and his younger brother was serving in the U.S. Navy. So, you know, my circumstances were a little bit different. I do bring that experience to Congress.
Norma Torres is a state senator representing California's 32nd senatorial district. We spoke with her from Sacramento, California, where she is running for the U.S. Congress. Senator, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
The first actual evidence of human-made fireworks in North America comes in about the 1200s. The Chinese, of course, beat that by a few centuries and are generally considered to be the inventors of gunpowder. But for a chemist, this time of year is a moment to celebrate all of the different ways we can release chemical energy very fast and very furiously. Oh, I love it. Well, one of those celebrating chemists we have on the line with us, Dr. John A. Conkling, professor of chemistry emeritus at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. Doctor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So when we go back to gunpowder, what is the chemical reaction there that produces the original fireworks?
Well, the potassium nitrate that's in gunpowder is the oxygen carrier. It contains oxygen as part of its chemical makeup. And then sulfur and charcoal are two fuels. The oxygen that comes from the potassium nitrate burns the sulfur, burns the charcoal at a very, very fast rate, particularly under confinement. And you get gas pressure, flame, you get an explosion.
So you heat up the potassium to a degree that the oxygen is released. It suddenly combines very, very quickly with the fuel, which is the charcoal and the sulfur. And depending on how you confine it, you get a pop or a sparkle or something like that.
Or motion. You have a propellant. If you leave one end open, you have a propellant, and that's how the first rockets were made.
Now, the Chinese, I understand, I was looking at this morning, actually invented the two-stage rocket, solid fuel rocket, you know, eons ago as well. Now, that doesn't involve any chemistry. It really involves the containment issue, right?
Pretty much, yes. Propellants are all about confining the hot gases that are generated.
Now, you are a former executive director and technical director of the American Pyrotechnics Association. Do you have a favorite configuration of fireworks, Roman candle, whatever that you particularly enjoy watching come all sort of unbundled chemically?
The aerial shell that is shot up in the air and then explodes up in the air, to me, gives the fireworks artist the ultimate canvas to paint on, which is a complete night sky. And they can do amazing things with the art aspect of fireworks up there in the sky.
I was talking to some mayors around the United States, and they don't allow the mayors to touch the fireworks anymore. The fire department does all of this, and they say it's all very electronic. And I'm wondering how technology has affected the ability to precisely time some of these explosions in the, you know, the shells that burst in the air.
Well, 30 years ago or more, every fireworks show was hand-fired. People would run around in the firing area lighting fuses, and fireworks would shoot up in the air. Now, for most of even the medium and particularly all the larger displays are electrically fired. Everything is wired back. All the shells are preloaded. Wires go back to a main firing console, and the show is programmed. A fireworks company will spend days and days, maybe weeks, for big shows choreographing the fireworks and the music, so the bursts in the sky perfectly match the notes that are being played with the music that's also being presented to the audience. And when it's done well, it's just an incredible experience to have that choreography. And that's one thing people can look for when they're watching shows.
Now, Dr. Conkling, if I were to call the cops there in Chestertown, Maryland, and they were to inspect your property, everything they'd find would be completely legal, right?
I am completely Maryland legal, yes.
All right. Dr. John Conkling, have a happy 4th of July.
Well, thank you very much. Same to you.
Dr. John Conkling is professor of chemistry emeritus at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. Way back in the 1930s, movies became the great American mass entertainment. But by the 1960s, Hollywood seemed to have lost its way in the rapids of change in music, pop culture, and the politics of the mid-20th century. But then, each with their distinct voices, writers and directors, Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, François Truffaut, Nora Ephron, Roger Corman, even Woody Allen, brought movies back, brought them back to the center of world culture. Movie critic Roger Ebert was one of those voices leading the way, a lover of movies with an eye for the truly great ones. Roger Ebert died last year after a long battle with throat cancer that turned his life into a public drama that played out unflinchingly before the public that adored him. A new documentary, Life Itself, shows Roger in his last 4 months of life. Roger Ebert's wife, Chaz, and director Steve James said Roger was determined to live life just as he watched his films, straight through to the end of the credits.
He came of age. He got this job at the birth of New American Cinema. And he saw that these films were really very much about the times we were living in. And that's what I loved about his review of Bonnie and Clyde, for example, where Roger talks about how this is a film that was made about the 30s and a crime spree in the 30s, but it's very much about us and who we are today. And I think those filmmakers had their finger on the pulse of what America was going through.
Some people have described Roger Ebert as this perfect cross between Pauline Kael, the intellectual who's sometimes out there near Pluto, and and Gene Shalit, who's a bit of a clown. But when you hear Ebert talking passionately about why he does what he does, that sense of democracy really comes through.
The purpose of civilization and growth is to be able to reach out and empathize a little bit with other people. And for me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy. It lets you understand a little bit more about different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears. It helps us to identify with the people who are sharing this journey with us.
Steve, tell us a little bit about his original collaboration with Gene Siskel. Here's a clip from 1987.
I'm Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times. Few films have been more eagerly awaited this summer than Full Metal Jacket, the Vietnam epic by Stanley Kubrick, and few films, I'm afraid, will be more disappointing. This isn't a bad film, but it's not a great film, and in the recent history of movies about Vietnam, Full Metal Jacket is too little and too late.
Boy, he was a ballsy guy.
That's right. That's Stanley Kubrick, who he loved. I mean, he loved Stanley Kubrick's work. But I think part of what made that union so remarkable was is that these were two very strong-willed men, very smart men, but who also kind of, I think, looked at movies in very different ways to some extent. And that clashing of views about what movies are to be and what resonates about films created some fabulous dialogue.
You would hear people saying, the first time I really learned to respect or understand why black and white films were important was watching Siskel and Ebert, why I understood why colorization was perhaps not the thing to do, why I should like a foreign film or a subtitled film. I think that he truly felt that film was a medium that expressed a visceral reaction to life.
Well, Roger and I were on a panel one time, I remember, and we disagreed about the movie Million Dollar Baby. Which is about a boxer who becomes a quadriplegic and kills herself as a result. A Clint Eastwood movie, Academy Award winner, a big movie. Roger was a real champion of it. I really had problems with it for disability reasons. And we had the best argument up on stage that I ever had in my life. It was great. He was very fair, but he was very intense. And the audience just sort of loved it at the end. And afterwards, he came over and said, you give as good as you get. And that was one of the highest compliments I ever got.
And he talked about that panel long after the panel took place.
Really?
He did. He took your comments to heart, your remarks. He said, who am I to say what was the right thing to do or what was not the right thing to do. He said, I was talking about it cinematically, but he said that you made him think about some things that he hadn't thought about.
Well, that is wild. Let's hear his review of Goodfellas, a movie I liked, but I can't really tell if Roger really loved this one here.
The life of the mafia in this film seems almost hermetically sealed. The characters don't associate with anyone else, and so their values come to seem valid to themselves because nobody disagrees with them.
Roger hated simplicity, even in Martin Scorsese.
Well, and it's remarkable, too, given that he had this friendship that he developed with Scorsese over the years. And there was a criticism leveled against Roger for, you know, like, is he too friendly with a filmmaker like Scorsese that he can't view him in an objective, in his films in an objective way? And I think that clip, as well as his review of Color of Money, sort of give lie to that concern.
Could he make or break a film, and did he understand that?
I think that he could influence people going out to see smaller films that maybe they wouldn't have seen because the films didn't have the budget to advertise.
Even from my own personal experience with my first film, Hoop Dreams, and with some of the films that we feature in the film itself, Errol Morris's Gates of Heaven, his first film, Gregory Nava's first film, El Norte. I mean,
My Dinner with Andre.
My Dinner
with
Andre,
which he made.
That would have been a My Dinner with Andre would have been a New York phenomena and nothing more had it not been for what Siskel and Ebert did.
You know, he chose to play his life out in a very public way, and his cancer was a particular kind of cancer that deprived him of his face, of his mouth, his ability to communicate. It was almost one of these sort of biblical level ironies of what happened to him. Yeah. Why did he choose to do that, and what did he say about what was happening to him?
The truth of the matter is, I think he was so hurt when he didn't know that Gene Siskel was dying. And he said, if something like this ever happens to me, I want to be more open about it, especially with people that we love and care about. I don't think he thought that he was going to do it so publicly. When Roger got out of the hospital after being in the hospital for almost a year, and he was going to go back to reviewing movies, even though not to broadcasting, he was advised by people who were close to us, and I know they thought they had his best interest at heart. Oh, you shouldn't go out in public. If people see you, your face is changed now. The surgery changed you, and the tabloids might take pictures of you. So what we did is we got a Sun Times photographer to come over, take the picture, put it on the front page, and Roger's caption was, "I ain't a pretty boy no more." And he said, "I don't care. This is what illness looks like. I'm not going to hide." I just loved him for that.
Well, we miss him. Boy, we miss him. I mean, you know, there's more than one time that I've thought to myself, what would Ebert say about that?
I think it every single week. What would Roger say? I wonder how he would explain this movie.
Roger Ebert's wife, Chaz, and director Steve James, their movie about Roger, Life Itself, is out in theaters tomorrow. A couple of weeks ago, the International Space Station made it onto the cover of the New Yorker magazine, a sly symbol of the Cold War tensions between the U.S. and Russia. There was a spacebound bicycle delivery guy there on the cover bringing Chinese food to the space station. The Chinese make perfectly good rockets these days, as well as mushu pork. It was a commentary on the seeming dearth of international cooperation in space right now. Ellen Stofan is chief scientist at NASA, who says she is laser-focused on an Earthling trip to Mars right now, and she's pretty optimistic about international cooperation, even given the challenges of taking the first big steps by 2030.
We want to make sure we can get humans safely to the surface of Mars and return them back to Earth and do that exploring of Mars that we're so interested in doing to get at that question of did life evolve on Mars, and if so, what was it like?
Now, a lot of scientists have already spent their entire scientific work lives on projects like Voyager, the Explorer projects on Mars, the Curiosity and the robot projects, for instance, and some projects that just kind of, you know, blew up on their way in either to Mars or some other planet. So scientists are used to sacrificing their entire lives for this kind of a mission. It gets a little different when you're talking about people just living on a planet. You really have to recruit people who will spend essentially much of their life in a place that's far removed from most of the other people like them.
Well, you know, we've been using the International Space Station to sort of start practicing for those eventualities, and that's why we really love the International Space Station. It's now been extended to 2024 because it's allowing us to learn how to live in another environment. We now have astronauts. We have a plan. We're going to send some astronauts up there for a full year to really start saying, how can we live in a different environment? How can we work in a different environment?
Do you think in your lifetime a human child will be born on a planet other than Earth?
I don't know. That's a great question. I certainly hope so. You know, I'm one of these people who's optimistic and I love to dream. And the thought that we're finally looking at, gosh, in the mid-2030s, we could really see that geologist, that astrobiologist walking on the surface of Mars, doing science on the surface of Mars, is something I'm incredibly excited about. And I think it's actually going to happen and we're going to see it happen. It's really an amazing thing to see come about.
Why do this when we have all these problems here on Earth? I'm sure you get that question every time you leave your office.
You know, one thing I always like to remind people is we spend all this money on Earth. We don't actually ship it off into outer space. You know, we're employing great people. We're trying to solve huge technological challenges. And when we do that as a nation, as an international group, to me, it's an investment in the future that in the long run is going to benefit us economically.
Now, you mentioned the International Space Station, and on one level, that's sort of a cautionary tale. On the other level, it's kind of an interesting surprise. A lot of scientists criticize the International Space Station as way too much of a compromise and really a useless piece of junk out there in space when it was originally designed and the final sort of, parameters were set. But it's turned out to be much more useful than we thought. Did those scientists just stop grumbling or what? And then, of course, this issue with Russia has made it a little bit difficult to be cooperative in space. How much international cooperation is going to be required for a Mars trip? Two-part question there.
Well, first of all, you know, we cooperate really well with the Russians on an everyday basis up on the International Space Station. And people have even talked about, oh, this should be nominated for a Nobel Prize to show how not just Russia and the United States, but spacefaring nations from all over the world came together and put together this laboratory in space that has been returning amazing science. In my job as chief scientist of NASA, I've really gotten to delve into what we've been doing on the International Space Station, and from looking at things like different phases of combustion we didn't know existed to understanding more about how cells and microbes work in zero gravity and how the human body responds is actually having us reflect on things like bone density loss and muscle wasting that affect people in old age here on Earth that we're now being able to study up on the space station. The scientific returns are just coming amazingly day after day. We're really utilizing this national, this international asset in a great way. And I think the trip to Mars will, you know, this path of global exploration to Mars is just that. It's global. And there's something called the Global Exploration Roadmap that NASA's been working on with multiple space agencies from around the world. And to do that kind of a big challenge, you know, to actually say we're going to put humans on the surface of another planet, it really has to be an international effort. And the international community is really excited about this, and they're on board.
And some of the compromises in engineering and in sort of scientific terms are part of the lessons you learn on a project like this.
You know, as a scientist, I've worked on NASA missions my entire career, and it's always a great balance between the scientists and the engineers to come up with the best, the most affordable solution you can to attack a problem. And to me, that's what makes NASA such a great place to work, is because you have those two communities where everybody's trying to really accomplish something with the technology we have, with the resources we have. And in general, NASA's really great at coming up with solutions to really get the job done.
You know, I've noticed how in the movie Gravity, the International Space Station suddenly got, you know, a kind of a Hollywood cameo. And the space station's got much more of a, it seems to me, a profile in popular culture Do you read The New Yorker?
I do.
Did you see that cover a couple weeks back of the International Space Station with this problems with the U.S. and Russia, and there's this bicyclist bringing Chinese food up to the space station?
I did, you know, and I must say I understood the commentary around it and behind it. But to me, when I looked at that, what I thought about was the fact that we've gotten commercial cargo up and running in the last several years, where we have Orbital and SpaceX who are now delivering cargo up to the space station on a routine basis. And so in a way, to me, I was interpreting it when I first saw the cartoon. I was interpreting that that guy on the bicycle was either Orbital or SpaceX, and that our deliveries now to the space station are becoming this routine commercial thing. And then I understood I had interpreted it incorrectly and not maybe politically. But, you know, it's an amazing thing that we now have these commercial companies bringing cargo. And our next step is going towards commercial crew, where we'll actually have commercial companies taking crew up. So I expect the next cartoon to have a bus going up there or something.
I like your interpretation better. You know, SpaceX is bringing the sesame noodles.
Exactly.
Ellen Stofan, NASA Chief Scientist, thanks so much.
Thank you. When you're gone, I am longing to see. I'm a traveling man,
moving through. I'm leaving on a jet. NASA scientists looking to go to Mars. We want to hear from you. Where would you go? Where would it be and why?
I would love to go anywhere off the face of this planet. I think it would be such an amazing experience to be able to see our planet from space firsthand, to be able to use the five senses to see, smell, feel, maybe even taste here.
Chris in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Listener from Florida wrote this: Japan, that country's history and culture interest me. I am of this world and have no desire of going to an environment where I wasn't made. I'm sure future generations will think of people like me as old-fashioned earthlings. We already think of you that way. Give us your take. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on any conversation. Listen back to anything on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great 4th of July, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You're in the tri-state and your high stakes hunting. You wake up in the morning saying you must make something. Well, I got something special to make that's motivating. Memories don't have like people. I have a backup, but I can't leave you. When you're gone, I am longing to see. I'm a traveling man, moving through space. I'm leaving on a big jet. When I'm gone, you get so upset. I'm a traveling man, moving through places. Pack my bags, arrange my suitcases. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.